Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Lori McGee, and it is my privilege to lead the service today. I am joined by Trish McLaughlin, who is serving as our worship associate. We are delighted to welcome you to this religious community.
These words are by Albert Einstein. There are two ways to live your life. One, as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle.
Well, apparently there's a greeting among the Mayan people that says, En la que, a la quien. When one person is walking in the forest and they hear someone coming, they shout out, En la que, and it means, I am another you. And the response is, a la quien, you are another me. So we are of the same tribe. You're safe. I am another you, and you are another me. En la que.
En la que.
A la quien.
A la quien.
En la que.
En la que.
A la quien.
A la quien.
Who am I?
Who am I?
I'm a child.
I'm a child.
Living in a world.
Living in a world.
Full of love.
Full of love.
Everywhere I go.
Everywhere I go.
Everyone I see.
Everyone I see.
Just another version.
Just another version.
Of me.
Of me.
One world, one ocean, one beauty. One mountain, one motion, one majesty. What if I'm another you and you are really just another version of me? I love you.
I love you.
I do.
I do.
What if I could only see that every person that I meet, every bird and every tree is just another part of me emerging?
Emerging.
What if it's true?
What if it's true?
En la que.
En la que.
A la que.
A la que.
En la que.
En la que.
A la que. Song to sing my heart awake. One candle burns for heaven's sake. One voice can turn a word to melody. One chance to call the earth a home. One nation never stands alone. One river moves the water to the sea. En la que.
En la que.
A la que.
A la que.
En la que.
En la que.
A la que.
A la que.
Who am I?
Who am I?
I'm a child.
I'm a child.
Living in a world.
Living in a world.
Full of love.
Full of love.
Everywhere I go.
Everywhere I go.
Everyone I see.
Everyone I see.
Just another version.
Just another version.
Of me.
Of me.
One world. One ocean. One beauty. One mountain. One motion. One majesty. What if I'm another you and you are really just another version of me? I love you.
I love you.
I do.
I do.
I love you.
I love you.
I do.
I do.
This reading is from The Island Within by Richard Nelson. There is nothing in me that is not of earth, no split instant of separateness, no particle that disunites me from the surroundings. I am no less than the earth itself. The rivers run through my veins. The winds blow in and out with my breath. The soil makes my flesh. The sun's heat smolders within me. A sickness or injury that befalls the earth befalls me. A fouled molecule that runs through the earth runs through me. Where the earth is cleansed and nourished, its purity infuses me. The life of the earth is my life. My eyes are the earth gazing at itself. Come, let us worship together.
Please join me now in the spirit of prayer or meditation, as is your practice. Truly, we thank you, doubly, triply, that we were created, that we were given our mouths and our faces. We are able to speak and to listen. We are able to ponder and to move about. We know much, for we have learned that which is far and near. We have seen the great and small, all that exists in the sky and on the earth. We thank you, therefore, that we were created, that we were given frame and shape. We became because of you, our grandmother, and you, our grandfather. On this blessed day, you, hurricane, you, heart of the sky and the earth, you, giver of ripeness and freshness, and you, giver of daughters and sons, spread your stain, spill your drops of green and yellow, give life and beginning to those we bear and beget, that they might multiply and grow, nurturing and providing for you, calling to you along the roads and the paths, on rivers, in canyons, beneath the trees and bushes. May there be no blame or barrier for us through any secrets or sorcery of yours. May your nurturers and providers be good before your mouth and your face. You, heart of sky, you, heart of earth, you, bundle of flames, and you, Toil, Awilix, Akowitz, under the sky, on the earth, the four sides, the four corners, may there be only light, only continuity within, before your mouth and your face, you, God. The Maya Empire, centered in the tropical lowlands of what is now Guatemala, reached the peak of its power and influence around the 6th century of the Common Era. The Maya excelled at agriculture, pottery, hieroglyph writing, calendar making, and mathematics, and left behind an astonishing amount of impressive architecture and symbolic work. Most of the great stone cities of the Maya were abandoned by 900 of the Common Era, and since the 19th century, scholars have debated on what might have caused this dramatic decline. The Mayan civilization was one of the most dominant of the indigenous societies of Mesoamerica, a term used to describe Mexico and Central America before the 16th century Spanish conquest. Unlike other scattered indigenous populations of Mesoamerica, the Maya were centered in one geographical block covering all of the Yucatan Peninsula and modern-day Guatemala, Belize and parts of the Mexican states of Tabasco and Chiapas, and the western part of Honduras and El Salvador. This concentration showed that the Maya remained relatively secure from invasion by other Mesoamerican peoples. With that expanse, the Maya lived in three separate sub-areas with distinct environmental and cultural differences. The northern Maya lowlands on the Yucatan Peninsula, the southern lowlands in the Petén district of northern Guatemala and adjacent portions of Mexico, Belize, and western Honduras, and the southern Maya highlands in the mountainous region of southern Guatemala. Most famously, the Maya of southern lowland region reached their peak during the classic period of Maya civilization, which occurred from 250 to 900 of the Common Era, and built the great stone cities and monuments that have fascinated explorers and scholars of the region, like Chichen Itza and Tikal. The earliest Maya settlements date to around 1800 before the Common Era, or the beginning of what is called the preclassic or formative period. The earliest Maya were agricultural, growing crops such as corn, beans, squash, and cassava. During the middle preclassic period, which lasted until about 300 before the Common Era, Maya farmers began to expand their presence both in the highland and lowland region. The middle preclassic period also saw the rise of the first major Mesoamerican civilization, the Olmecs. Like other Mesoamerican people, such as the Zapotec, Totonac, Teotihuacan, and Aztec, the Maya derived a number of religious and cultural traits, as well as their number system and their famous calendar, from the Olmecs. And if you've ever traveled to that region and you've seen any of those monuments, those giant stone heads, those are Olmec, from the Olmec people. In addition to agriculture, the preclassic Maya also displayed more advanced cultural traits like pyramid building, city construction, and the inscribing of stone monuments. The classic period, which began around 250 of the Common Era, was the golden age of the Maya Empire. Classic Maya civilization grew to some 40 cities, including Tikal, Huacatun, Copan, Bonampak, Dos Pillas, Calakmul, Palenque, and Riobec. Each city held a population of between 5,000 and 50,000 people. At its peak, the Maya population may have reached 2 million. Excavations of Mayan sites have unearthed plazas, palaces, temples, and pyramids, as well as courts for playing the ball games that were ritually and politically significant to Mayan culture. Mayan cities were surrounded and supported by a large population of farmers. Though the Maya practiced a primitive type of slash-and-burn agriculture, they also displayed evidence of more advanced farming methods, such as irrigation and terracing. The Maya were deeply religious and worshipped various gods related to nature, including the gods of the sun, the moon, rain, and corn. At the top of Maya society were the kings, or Kahu Aja, holy lords, who claimed to be related to gods and followed a hereditary succession. They were thought to serve as mediators between the gods and the people on earth, and performed the elaborate religious ceremonies and rituals so important to Mayan culture. The classic Maya built many of their temples and palaces in a steeped pyramid shape, decorating them with elaborate reliefs and inscriptions. These structures have earned the Maya their reputation as the great artists of Mesoamerica. Guided by their religious ritual, the Maya also made significant advances in mathematics and astronomy, including the use of zero and the development of a complex calendar system based on 365 days, which we know did not end, right? Okay. Though early researchers concluded that the Maya were a peaceful society of priests and scribes, later evidence, including a thorough examination of the artwork and inscriptions on their temple walls, showed a less peaceful side of Mayan culture, including the war between rival Mayan cities city-states and the importance of torture and human sacrifice in their religious ritual. Serious exploration of classic Maya sites began in the 1830s. By the early to mid-20th century, a small portion of their system of hieroglyph writing had been deciphered, and more about their history and culture became known. Most of what historians know about the Maya comes from what remains of their architecture and art, including stone carvings and inscriptions on their buildings and monuments. The Maya also made paper from tree bark and wrote in books made from this paper known as the codices. Four of these codices are known to have survived. One of the many intriguing things about the Maya was their ability to build a great civilization in a tropical rainforest climate. Traditionally, ancient peoples had flourished in the drier climates, where centralized management of water resources through irrigation and other techniques formed the basis of society. This was the case for Teotihuacan of Highland Mexico, contemporaries of the classic Maya. The Teotihuacan people eventually became Aztec. In the southern Maya lowlands, however, there were few navigable rivers for trade and transport, as well as no obvious need for an irrigation system. By the late 20th century, researchers had concluded that the climate of the lowlands was, in fact, quite environmentally diverse. Though foreign invaders were disappointed by the region's relative lack of silver and gold, the Maya took advantage of the area's many natural resources, including limestone for construction, the volcanic rock obsidian for tools and weapons, and salt. The environment also held other treasures for the Maya, including jade, quetzal feathers, used to decorate the elaborate costumes of Maya nobility, and marine shells, which were used as trumpets in ceremonies and warfare. From the late 18th century through the end of the 9th century, the 8th century through the end of the 9th century, something unknown happened to shake the Maya civilization to its foundations. One by one, the classic cities in the southern lowlands were abandoned, and by 900 of the Common Era, Maya civilization in that region had collapsed. The reason for this mysterious decline is unknown, although scholars have developed several competing theories. Some believe that by the 9th century, the Maya had exhausted the environment around them to the point that it could no longer sustain a very large population. Other Maya scholars argue that constant warfare among competing city-states led the complicated military, marriage, and trade alliances between them to break down. Along with the traditional system of dynastic power. As the stature of the holy lords diminished, their complex traditions of rituals and ceremonies dissolved into chaos. Finally, some catastrophic environmental change, like an extremely long, intense period of drought, may have wiped out the classic Maya civilization. Drought would have hit cities like Tikal, where rainwater was necessary for drinking as well as crop irrigation, especially hard. All three of these factors, overpopulation and overuse of land, endemic warfare, and drought, may have played a part in the downfall of the Maya in the southern lowlands. In the highlands of the Yucatan, a few Maya cities, such as Chichen Itza, Uxmal, and Mayapan, continued to flourish in the post-classic period. By the time the Spanish invaders arrived in the early 16th century, however, most Maya were living in agricultural villages, their great cities buried under a layer of rainforest green. The Spanish conquistadors began a systematic attempt to completely dismantle what was left of the Mayan civilization. Hundreds of books were burned, but the Maya preserved their culture underground. And one of the ways they did this was by writing out their books in the Roman alphabet. That way, even if the Maya eventually forgot their own script, because the Spanish outlawed it, they could read Maya books in the new official language imposed by the Spanish. The Popol Vuh, and I've brought my books here, this is the Spanish and this is the English translation. The Popol Vuh is the most important of these saved books. It is at once a work of myth and a work of history. It tells the story of how the sea and the sky gods joined together before the beginning of time to create land, plants, and living creatures on the earth, and stars and planets and suns in the sky. The Popol Vuh also tells the story of the ancestral Maya lords who passed down their titles and responsibilities from generation to generation, giving their names and roles. Popol Vuh roughly means council book or book of the people, and had been used for centuries by Maya leaders to give them instructions when in making important decisions. So the remarkable Popol Vuh records from the beginning of time to the present day of its writers, switching from myth to history and tying the two together, guide the Maya. We are able to be guided by Popol Vuh today thanks to the efforts of many translators and one thief. In 1701, a Spanish priest named Francisco Jimenez, living and working in the Quiché territory, copied Popol Vuh with a phonetic Mayan in one column and a Spanish translation in the other, creating the first version that Europeans could read. Jimenez's version was acquired by the University of San Carlos in Guatemala City in 1830. In 1857, an Austrian physician, Carl Scherzer, came upon the manuscript, which he published in Europe, and later a French priest, Charles Brasseur, stole the manuscript and took it to Paris. After his death in 1874, a large collection of books, including Popol Vuh, was sold to American Edward Ayer, who donated them all to the Newberry Library in Chicago in 1911, and they are still there. Popol Vuh was then completely forgotten until 1941, when Adrián Resinos rediscovered it and published it. Now it is acclaimed and translated around the world. The Popol Vuh is divided into three essential parts. The first is a description of the creation of the earth, the animals, and the first human, part of which we heard in the reading, and we're going to hear a little bit more. The second part centers on the narrative of the adventures of the hero twins, Unapu and Ixbalanque, the young gods that defeat the evil forces of Xibalba, or hell, the underworld. The third part is a detailed history relating the origin of the indigenous peoples of Guatemala, their migrations, distributions within the territory, war, and the dominance of the Quiché race over the others until shortly before the Spanish conquest. The richness of these accounts, the symbolism of the characters, and the implied meaning in the story have made this book a classic on par with the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Ramayana, or even the Bible itself, but above all, for being one of the few reliable examples of the world's most enigmatic and mysterious civilizations. The Popol Vuh is physically a small book, but its contents are vast and deep. It describes the creation of the earth, animals, and humans, the nature of heaven and hell, the character of the gods themselves. It recounts the importance of the juego de la pelota, or the ball game, the acquiring of fire, and the genealogies of the first tribes of Maya forefathers. There's far too much in one small book to talk about in one service, so I would like to lift up just a few stories this morning that I think best illustrate the connection we share with this ancient and mysterious people of the rainforest. Before we can understand any of these stories in the Popol Vuh, it's important to understand the nature of the gods themselves. The ancient Maya believed in a vast pantheon of gods and supernatural beings. The main god was Gucumatz, the plumed serpent, known also as Kukulcan to some Maya tribes and Quetzalcoatl to the Aztec. The gods almost always worked in pairs or teams, and the counterpart to Gucumatz was Tepeu, a sky god. These two together were called the maker and the modeler, the bearer and the begetter. Another deity that figures prominently in Popol Vuh is Heart of Sky, who is made up of three parts: hurricane, raw thunderbolt, and new thunderbolt. These gods, plus many, many others, have no physical form. Their job is to meet, think, decide, guide, create, destroy. Additionally, there are the supernatural beings who do the work the gods decide needs to be done on Earth, and they do have physical form. In Popol Vuh, there's a whole genealogical tree of these beings. Ikshpiakak and Ikshmukane, meaning the grandparents of all of them. These two are most important, given their position as elders, and the main gods, Tepeyu and Kukumax, often turn to them for advice and help. However, the hero twins, Unapu and Ikshbalanke, are the text's central figures, the boys who defeat the lords of Xibalba, the Maya underworld, and become the sun and the moon. In his article, The Mayan Faith, Monroe Edmondson sums up the Mayans' view of their gods. The Mayan idea of God was explicitly unitary. God was called the unified God, an expression capturing with precision this deity's essence as singular and plural at the same time. For if the idea of a unified God satisfied the need for philosophical monism, the idea of God as a progenitor equates this with dualism, a dualism profoundly embedded in Mayan thought and language. God is normally addressed in prayers as mother and father, and the metaphor of creation explicitly equates this parenthood with both the bearing and the engendering of the world. If monotheism was no surprise to the Maya, neither was the Trinity. For the Mayan god was multiplied into almost indefinite numbers of committees of numerologically significant deities to satisfy the requirements of a ramified and mathematically precise cosmology. All of them were nonetheless aspects of a unitary conception of godhood, and polytheism is a poor description of Mayan belief. When it comes to creation, we heard part of the story with Karen's reading this morning. And there were two attempts to make man before that final man of corn was created. Those first attempts were not successful. The first one occurs early on in the book when Tepeyu and Gukumats realize that in order to survive, they need to be prayed to be worshipped, to have offerings made to them. If there was no one on the earth they created to do these things, they would cease to exist. The gods recognize that without humans, they would be nothing, a direct departure from the Christian God many of us are used to. So they came together with other gods and decide to create man. Nothing in Popol Vuh is done without decision and planning. They meet again and again before any action is taken. That sounds familiar, right? They decide to make the first man out of the material of the new earth, dirt and water. This man of mud, however, cannot stand or think and is quickly destroyed. The gods take their failure in stride and just try again. In their next attempt, they turn to Ikshpiakak and Ikshmukane, the grandparent supernatural beings. They need the help of these elders to try to get it right. The grandfather and grandmother work and work, and soon there are people of wood populating the face of the earth. They have sons and daughters, homes, pets, lives, but they do not remember who created them. They do not pray. They do not offer sacrifices to any of the gods. Tepeyu and Gukumats, together with the other gods, realize the failure of this second attempt at humankind. They decide that these wood people must also be destroyed, and they bring a huge flood over the face of the earth. The wood people scatter, trying to save themselves, and all but a few perish. The few that remain become monkeys in the trees, being left as a sign of previous human design. They resemble humans, but are mere mannequins, mere wood carvings. In my opinion, this story shows a bit of creationism and evolution at the same time. A contradiction that the Maya were comfortable with. The gods created the wood people, but when they are destroyed, they evolve into monkeys to remind us of what not to become. Mere wood carvings, unable to pray or worship. Finally, the gods come together again, and with the help of the animals this time, are able to create man. It should come as no surprise to us as modern people that the final successful attempt at creation of man is made of corn. Corn was and continues to be today the most important food staple to Mayan and Central American peoples. It makes perfect sense that man would be comprised of corn and water. Without these things, the ancient Maya would have perished. The corn people were given names, Jaguar Kitse, Jaguar Knight, Mwaukata, and True Jaguar. They talked, made words, looked, listened, walked, and worked. They were good people. Thoughts came into existence and they gazed. Perfectly that they saw. Perfectly they knew everything under the sky. However, fearing that humans would strive to be godlike if they were able to see everything on earth and know everything at once, their vision was limited. They were blinded as the face of a mirror that is breathed upon. Now it is only when they looked nearby that things were clear. This was an important lesson to the Maya. One should not be great as the gods. One should remember always to pray, give thanks, and worship. Shortly after this, four women are created in the same way as the men and are given equal status as ladies, as great ladies who would give birth to the people of the tribes and of the tribes, small and great. These stories have many lessons, but for me the most important is the ability, the necessity for a chance at a do-over. In the Christian creation story, the story of Adam and Eve, God gets it right the first time. The biblical God gets it right every first time. What would it have meant to Western society if we had learned the Mayan story? What would it have meant to you if you knew that God could get it wrong and try again? I know what it would have meant to me. The concept of sin would have gone right out the window. If I did something wrong but tried again and again until I got it right, well, where's the sin in that? It would also mean that God wasn't perfect, that perfection was not usually attained on the first try. We as a society would perhaps be more forgiving of others, more compassionate in our dealings with each other, more loving to our fellow man if we were raised, if we lived with the idea of a do-over. The second story I would like to lift up this morning is a very small part of a much larger story about the hero twins, Hunapu and Ixbalanque, that I mentioned earlier, whose story I will tell in a bit if we have time. When the boys were young, the boy's father, Hunapu, and uncle, Vukupunapu, were killed by the lords of Xibalba because their ball game made so much noise in the underworld. Upon becoming young men, Hunapu and Ixbalanque discover the ball game equipment of their predecessors and start to play each other on the ball court. When the lords of Xibalba hear the noise again, they summon the boys to their realm, hoping to defeat them like they did the father and uncle. A messenger from Xibalba informs their grandmother, Ixmukane, who in turn needs to inform the boys who are still out on the ball court. For this, she employs the help of a louse. She tells the louse her message and sends it to fetch Hunapu and Ixbalanque. Soon the louse meets a toad. When the toad learns of the importance of the louse's mission, he offers to carry the louse in his belly so he'll get there faster. The louse hops in the toad's mouth and off they go. And soon they meet a snake. The snake wants to help as well and offers to carry the toad in his belly because he, the snake, can travel much faster. So the toad hops in and off they go. Soon they are seen by a falcon. The falcon can get them to the boys fastest of all and gobbles up the snake. When they reach the ball court, the falcon spits out the snake and the snake spits out the toad and the toad spits out the louse and the message is delivered. The lesson of this story is collaboration and cooperation. The Maya were a mostly peaceful people and it was important to remain that way. Survival in the rainforest was not easy, and in order to do this, the different tribes would have needed to stay in peaceful contact with each other. Knowing a story in which animals that would normally eat each other instead help each other would be one way to keep the peace. This is something modern people could benefit from as well, especially in times of such political division that we have now. The final story I would like to share with you this morning is how Hunapu and Ixbalanque, the hero twins, are able to defeat the lords of the underworld. After the boys are told the message from the louse, they travel to Xibalba, taking their game equipment with them. Once in the underworld, they are met with a series of tests meant to defeat and kill them, each of which they cleverly survive. Enraged by this, the lords of Xibalba challenge them to a ball game. The boys purposely lose and are sent off to be defeated by one of the lords of Xibalba. And they cleverly survive this test, and this goes on and on and on until they go through all of the nine houses of hell, Xibalba, the underworld, and they survive all but the last one. When Hunapu is killed in the last house, they go through this sort of magical, mystical process and are even able to overcome this, and Ixbalanque is able to bring Hunapu back to life. So, seeing this, the lords of Xibalba think, wow, we want to die and come back to life too. So they say to Hunapu and Ixbalanque, we want you to do this to us. So Hunapu and Ixbalanque say, sure, we'll do that to you. And they defeat the lords of Xibalba, but they don't bring them back to life. And therefore, the lords of Xibalba are defeated. So, achieving victory, they depart Xibalba, climbing back up to the surface of the earth, but they do not stop there and continue on and on and on and become the sun and the moon. Through this story and many others in Popol Vuh, we can see the importance of good triumphing over evil. In the book, good always triumphs over evil, no matter how long it takes. It is an uplifting and life-affirming message that must have meant so much to the ancient Maya. Faced with a world which is often incomprehensibly difficult to manage, believing that good would win out in the end would have been significant. Christopher Chiappari uses the idea of good overcoming evil as a crucial understanding in Maya religious belief through the lens of liberation theology. Liberation theology, at its essence, is the political movement in Catholic theology which interprets the teachings of Jesus Christ in terms of a liberation from unjust economic, political, or social conditions. It developed in Latin America in the middle of the last century, and the term itself was coined in 1971 by Gustavo Gutierrez in his book, A Theology of Liberation. Chiappari, in his article, Toward a Maya Theology of Liberation, states, on an abstract level, liberation theology and Mayan religion share some general goals in common. Liberation from suffering and spiritual advancement, improving social and moral conditions for society and world at large, and greater harmony in the cosmos. While liberation theology is and has been a political and social movement, it is at its core a spiritual one. There is no better way to illustrate this point than through the story of the hero twins overcoming the evil lords of the underworld again and again. I believe that we, as Unitarian Universalists, have much in common with the ancient Maya. We believe in the concept of a do-over. We aspire to collaborate and cooperate with diverse people. And we fight for the triumph of good over evil. We respect the earth and all the creatures upon it. We recognize the interdependent web of which we are all a part. We respect the faith of others, even though we may not understand it ourselves. We value human experience as the agent for meaning-making in our lives. Edmondson sums up these thoughts when he says, the Mayan faith may be seen as the point of intersection, articulation, and integration of all other salient domains of Mayan experience, environing geography, the human body, animals and plants, feelings, morals, aesthetics, meteorology, astronomy, social relations, the whole world of things seen and unseen, provides a matrix of interlocking metaphors that link one domain to another in a highly redundant synthesis of all that exists. This is how I view Unitarian Universalism, a world of things seen and unseen, a matrix of interlocking metaphors, a synthesis of all that exists. May it be so, and amen. Go as you go, in peace, in love and community. Amen.